The camp that I was in, it wasn't too bad. Partly because I think the administrator was a fairly decent guy. But it was split into the two camps of people who were very, very nationalistic and those who said that they would be in the army if they were called for. And petty things which went on between families who took these points on different points of view. They wouldn't talk to each other. And I think that was the most terrible period as far as I can remember, the confusion and animosity between people that were friends for years. And I remember the time my brother volunteered for this language specialty thing, and I lived in a block where there are a lot of people who felt that it was wrong, you know, how many times can you turn the other cheek sort of business. And they were very, very critical that my brother would do such a thing. The older people, they would come up and they would say very, very insulting things to my mother about the fact that how could you let your son go into the army. Well, I do remember, though, at the time that there were sons that were disowned by the family for having signed the loyalty oath or having joined the army. They were disowned. All of it's forgotten, but at the period, it was a very, very terrible, terrible time, because I remember some kids that I knew in camp at that time, and they were telling me that they thought that my brother was very fortunate to have a family that didn't make it so miserable for him.
The only incident that I recall very vividly is where it involved one family. They had four sons. The father, I believe, it didn't make too much difference to him. But the mother of the boys, she was definitely pro-Japanese, and as it turned out, the whole family was sent back to Japan, and she had that much, she exerted that much pressure on her sons and her husband. And the other incident that I can recall is where it involves a relation of mine, and he volunteered minute Pearl Harbor was broadcasted, and it was accepted. And while in the service, I do recall his, we weren't in the same relocation center, but I do recall his mother and father telling us later how they were ostracized because their sons had volunteered.
I think the treatment of the Japanese during the war was, I would say, very miserable. I think it was inexcusable. Having lived among the Japanese until the time I was in service, I felt that there could be no question as to their loyalty to the country of their adoption, even in a crisis. Perhaps it was because of the feelings of my mother and father and of my brothers and sisters and of my neighbors. But I felt that when the time came to decide, that they would decide for America and not for Japan. This isn't to say that in the negotiation period prior to the war, that there wasn't among the older Japanese some feelings for Japan. But I feel sure that when the crucial decision had to be made between America and Japan, that the decision would have been in favor of America. Prior to Pearl Harbor, there was quite a lot of discussion among the Japanese, especially among the older Japanese, not too much among the younger ones. I think such discussions would have been in the nature that Japan needed to expand, that America was standing in her way of expansion, that Japan needed foodstuff and a place to, and a marketplace for her goods. But I think such talk came because the older Japanese, though they've been in America quite a long time, weren't quite fully accepted in the American community, and so they had to feel that they belonged to some country. My mother, she had to sell her business at a fantastically low price, store other things, some of which were stolen, and she took only the minimum to the relocation center. I felt that she always looked upon Japan as the land of her birth and a land to which she must one day go back and visit. But I think because of her children, she felt that her allegiance lay with the United States. I don't think that it would be any exaggeration to say that the monetary loss among the Japanese prior to evacuation was very great. In many cases, I think they lost things which I think cannot be repaid financially. I think emotionally it was a tremendous experience for them. I think by now that if the experience hadn't been forgotten, the scars have long healed over. The country to which I belong was entitled to make a mistake, as long as it once righted that mistake in later years. It's good enough for me.
When the war was over, the Japanese could return to their homes and begin to pick up the threads of their lives. Many found new jobs and new places to live. Many had a difficult time readjusting. For none of them would life ever be the same as it was before the war.
The worst thing about how it happened was that it came so sudden, the government wasn't equipped to take care of property. People had stores, people had crops growing. I mean, all those kinds of things. There just wasn't time to take care of those kinds of things. So there was a tremendous loss in property, personal property. Although since the war, we did work on an evacuation claims program, and the government did pass such a program, and most of the people have been given a token compensation for their losses. The amount was nowhere near what the losses actually were, because if you get uprooted from your home all of a sudden, you don't know exactly what you had in your home, when you bought it, how much it was worth, and all those things are involved, you see. And then when you come to business, things like goodwill, people had to hire non-Japanese to take over their business operations. When you've been in business for 20 years, what is the worth of goodwill and all those kinds of things which are intangibles, you see? Then you've been making so much per year, your records show it, but anticipated profits were knocked out of the evacuation claims value.
I'm the editor of the English section of the Nichibei Times, the Japanese American daily. We lost every piece of our equipment during the war. The company was dissolved, and we had to scrape up pieces here and there and reorganized completely mechanically and otherwise. It was quite a difficult thing to do at that time because, well, Japanese type was, as you may figure, it was very scarce. And as far as the readership was concerned, we just had to wait until the people all came back. And as a paper, our circulation is much smaller than prior to the war. But
as much as, you know, just speaking very theoretically, I mean, we felt that our rights were violated and all that sort of thing, but I would say that this evacuation for the younger Japanese did a great deal. I mean, it killed our parents, however. I mean, that's the only thing about it. My father was never a very outspoken person, and he worked hard. He used to have to work 10, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week practically, with his little shop in Stockton. And but all I know is that when he had to sell out his shop and start packing to move, I think his, his life just sort of slowed to a crawl. I mean, he had no reason to exist after that. You know, we were grown up, and we didn't depend on him anymore, and I think he just, he just felt that there was no longer any reason for him to exist. He worked hard, and he was healthy, so there's no reason why he wouldn't have, lived to be 70 or so on and so forth, but he died about 4 years ago.
If World War II forced the Japanese to leave the Pacific coast, it also forced thousands of Americans to go to Japan, first as conquerors, later as allies. Many of the Americans liked Japan, and some of them took Japanese brides. A few of these marriages did not work out, and lonely Japanese girls found themselves in a strange land, far from home, needing the services of a lawyer.
Probably handled maybe 100 or 150 cases all told on the war brides, and they come from different backgrounds. By and large, most of the cases I've handled for war brides involved mixed marriages, either between the war bride and a Caucasian, or the husband is usually either Caucasian or Negro. And once in a while, I've run into the problems of war brides where they've been married to Nisei or Chinese, but those are very exceptional. And most of the problems seem to stem from those families in which the husband is still in the service, and there's separation, long periods of separation. Bottomner referred to me because the language problem. I'm well enough versed in Japanese so that I can, it's much easier for most of the war brides to speak in Japanese, I mean, especially when they're consulting with an attorney. And sometimes there are agencies that know that I'm around. Sometimes it's a referral from one war bride to another. And sometimes it's a referral from another attorney who feels that he can't handle the situation because he has a language handicap. I would probably have a somewhat distorted view if I just looked at my files. I might conclude that these marriages were not, on the whole, successful. On the other hand, if you look at the statistics on the immigration or the immigration of war brides, Japan has a quota of 185 people who can come over here for permanent residence. The war brides are non-quota, and on the average, the immigration statistics show that there's been between 4,000 to 5,000 war brides coming into this country annually since about 1950. And I would say that roughly one out of every six person of Japanese ancestry in this country today is a war bride. So that if you weight my experience, and possibly I handle the vast majority of the domestic relations problems of the war brides in this area, I don't think that proportionately that it runs any worse than the population as a whole. Possibly it runs a better percentage, that is a lesser percentage, break up of marriage. I've seen some situations where they've had nothing but misery since they've come here, but I guess because they have come from a background where they had seen much more adversity, that the worst situations that they have run into in this country are still better than the situations that they might face if they go back to Japan. And added to that, some of them feel that they have to stay here because they've entered into the marriage against parental wishes, and the village where they came from might have frowned upon a mixed marriage, and therefore that they would find a hostile home or a hostile community to go back to. In other instances, war brides are more or less orphans to begin with, or they've lost their families, or they've lost contact with their families, or their families are very poor, so that the situation in Japan would be much worse. And another factor which makes them probably a little more adaptable to the type of adversity that they might run into here is the fact that most of the war brides were children during the war. And they never had the kind of easy childhood that most of us feel is ideal, or most of the children probably raised here are accustomed to, so that they went through childhood with many, many handicaps, and they're not used to. I mean, they don't expect that everything's going to be a bed of roses, I mean, in marriage or otherwise. So their outlook is probably a little bit better from the standpoint of adjusting themselves to a foreign country, foreign languages, foreign customs, and a marriage which probably is less than ideal from the type of dream marriages that we concoct.
It's kind of lonely because since we left my folks, you know, from Japan, in a new country, but since I married a Japanese American, my husband is a Nisei, what you call. So his friend is all Japanese, and his folks are Japanese, so I didn't feel much left out because everything very familiar to me, since food is, we can still eat Japanese food, and around my folks is Japanese. One thing, when I started looking the job, and right after I came over, that's because if I found a job among American, my English getting better much faster. That's what I decided to work a little bit. Then I went to agency and all over the looking around job, but they asked me about American citizenship first, and so that thing is, you know, almost like I found a job, and then you don't have American citizenship, so I can't give you a job. That thing is, I just, makes me discouraged. Well, that can be helped because I can get American citizenship at least 3 years, so that at that time I didn't have, you know. Otherwise, I really didn't have much bad time.
There are many minority groups in America, and most of them have formed associations to protect their rights. The organization of the Japanese is the JACL, the Japanese American Citizens League.
I was one of the founders of the JACL in San Francisco way back, and it was very hard to get started in those days because the youths were quite pro-Japanese at that time, and they didn't like the idea of us organizing a citizens group. In fact, one of the first group was organized in Fresno, and they called themselves the American Loyalty League. And then Seattle had a group called the Progressive Citizens League, and we were the first ones to form under the Japanese American Citizens League. We've organized that in San Francisco. Saburo Kido, who's a big man JCL, and some of us got together and organized the JCL. I served as president two or three times, and we really had a very lowly start. Well, they used to say they couldn't join anyhow, but a lot of them tried to prevent their sons and daughters from coming in at that time. Well, a lot of them were bitter because they weren't able to get citizenship, and there was a lot of prejudice. So they felt that as long as we were treated as orphans, why should we be loyal to this country? But that attitude has changed an awful lot since. This was way back in 29 or 30, around there. We had a very difficult time getting that thing started. I remember Kito and I just alternated presidency there for 5 or 6 years before we take hold.
You know, I was one of these bright little intellectual liberal types, let's put it this way. So to actually go out with someone from a minority group was a little different from talking about it with people. And I think all of a sudden I became conscious that maybe we couldn't go here, we couldn't go there. And I had never had to think about this before, you know. And I sort of had the feeling in the back of my mind that I would never really get involved with this man, you know. Very nice guy, I'll talk to him, he'll be a good friend. And I really felt quite sure that this was going to be just a friendship, you know. And I think I never spelled it out to myself, but I had a definite feeling that this was a closed off relationship. I think in some ways I felt a lot sharpened up a lot more than I used to be about who I want to know, who my friends are. I'm much more aware of what people think about Negroes, Orientals, mixed marriages. You know, before, since I was one of the big white majority, it didn't matter. You know, you talk to these people all the time, and you might disagree with them, but you're one of them, kind of. But I think that the only thing that happened since I've been married is this feeling of I'm no longer one of this majority. You know, I'm sort of, I have another loyalty, kind of, and I find myself not wanting to know people I might not have even cared about how they thought before. And now I just sort of have a stronger feeling about this. I don't want them for friends. Some funny things have happened with, the baby. Just little tiny things, and I don't think that she'll run into any real trouble. At the co-op the other day, somebody looked at Kimi and said, "Oh, isn't she a polite baby?" This kind of thing, you know. But they're going to be pretty kids. You know, I think that all of our kids would be very good-looking kind of kids. And this helps, just to be pretty helps, you know, in this world. You know, so I think some other funny things, like this neighbor down the street kind of thing that happens, where because another person and I are in the same group, or they identify with me, you know, you're okay, and it gives them an in to look at this curiosity that is our marriage, you know? And this is just a feeling you get from people of this particular kind, you know? The sort of being in the house and, oh, there he is again, you know? And looking at you sort of more closely, like, what's this all about? If they have a party, it's nice that they can sort of show off their interracial friends or something like this, you know?
Issei, Nisei, Sansei. Three generations of Japanese Americans, with the fourth already on its way. Some of them remember the language of their parents. Some of them hold to the ancient religion, but most of them have become much more American than Japanese.
I think I could say this, that as far as my work is concerned with the people I work with, co-workers and clients, that
I think it's very easy to forget that I am a Japanese American. I find myself every once in a while thinking about, my goodness, I'm treated like anybody else. And I think, well, my God, I'm not really, by racial features and all that, an American. I mean, so-called American. I'm an Oriental, but it doesn't seem to bother anybody, and it doesn't bother me as much as it did a long time ago.
I mean, I don't go to the Buddhist church regularly, but I feel that I'm still Buddhist. I belong to the Buddhist church. And my mother is in town, so I speak to her in as much Japanese as I can muster. And they do have Japanese movies, and I rarely go, but they are available. And I don't think there's any strong tie as such, and I don't think the Japanese community as such exists as it used to, as it did in the past.
Kind of a peculiar feeling, like when I'm with Japanese Americans, then I feel like I'm thinking like an American. And yet when I'm with the non-Japanese, then I feel like I have to take a certain kind of position and a certain kind of stand because I'm Japanese American. It's kind of a funny feeling.
And that does it for this week's From the Vault. We'd like to say a special thank you to Addie Gevins for helping us with this series being preserved and represented to the Pacifica Network listeners. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and past grants from the Grammy Foundation and the American Archive Pilot Project funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This program was written and produced by Mark Torres and Brian DeShazer. The series is executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and your host, Brian DeShazer. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Thanks for listening.